What do you hate most about Bitcoin?
Bitcoin is such a ugly system. They're like in many aspects. And the NSA chief says that they kill people based on metadata. They don't need to read the actual message of the content. It's enough for them to find out who's talking to whom, and they'll send the drones in to make a killing strike. But like today, we have tax rates that exceed 70%. Like, at what point are you a slave, you know, with how much wealth is being stolen from you on a daily basis? They can easily impose programmable limits. Like, you can only spend this money in this area, right? And you cannot leave your 15-minute city with the tokens. That is something that is actively being discussed with central bank digital currencies. Copyright, patent are deeply, deeply evil.
If governments banned privacy tomorrow, what would you do?
All views expressed by the host or guests are solely their own opinions. Nothing stated in this podcast should be considered a specific endorsement to make any particular investment or follow any specific strategy.
Welcome to All in Bitcoin, Max. Today we are making economics simple. But first, let's get to know you a little bit better. Ready?
Yeah. I really like economics. It's something that has taught me so much. And it seems such a dry topic when you get to learn it in school. But actually, if you think about it properly, it's a really useful aspect for general life. It helped me a lot, for example, in my family life or with friends as well. So it's not just all about making money, just about helping people. It's basically what economics is about. And it's always good to get more into it.
And you say that it helped you a lot with family and friends. How?
Yeah, just generally that aspect of, you know, helping people, like solving problems for others. That's at the core of human action and of economics. And sure, that extends to like the monetary realm, right? And to solve problems in order to make money. But you don't have to get paid financially to solve the problems.
Give me one example of advice you have given to your family or friends that helped them in daily life.
I think that just that aspect of saving, right, of making sure that you build now so that it's easier to solve problems in the future, right? That savings and kind of trading with yourself in the future is useful.
Yeah. Okay, so what's one habit you have that will make any government nervous?
Well, you know, I think just having that mindset of not liking theft. That's really one of my general habits of I don't like theft and I'd like to avoid being stolen from and I'd like to help others to not be stolen from. And that's... Yeah, people who steal a lot don't like that. That their victims all of a sudden do something that prevents the thief. And I guess generally that aspect of making it very expensive to steal and making it very cheap to defend yourself and others. And that asymmetry is extremely, extremely powerful. And so over the last decade or so, I've really thought hard and worked on the tools that make theft unprofitable.
Yeah, that's a habit, you
that's
can say.
That's a habit. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So Dostoevsky wrote, "The mystery of human existence lies not in just staying alive, but in finding something to live for."
Yeah.
What gives your life direction?
I think to summarize it would be to end slavery. I think slavery is a really, really, really bad thing. It's evil, it's unproductive, it's wasteful, it just doesn't make sense. Like humans are there to do something better than being a slave to a master. And that is something that guides me for a long time now. And I think there is a lot of purpose in that quest, right? To raise others and to help others become a better version of themselves. And I think slaves are kind of by definition not the best version of themselves, because we're not meant to be slaves. We're meant to be free and to build something beautiful and delightful. And having that ability to not just do that for myself, but for others and to scale it to hopefully millions of people has huge impact. And so yeah, that's what keeps me going.
What's something you keep delaying?
That's a good question. You have good questions. Honestly, not that much. I I do the things that kind of need to be done. I like to do them early and swiftly. So nothing really concrete comes to mind. Not the best answer to a really deep question.
Is convenience the enemy of freedom?
Kind of yes and no. Because most technologies that we use are designed so that the convenient path is the path to slavery or the path to theft, right? But I do believe very strongly that we can build technologies where the convenient option is the secure option. And that's extremely hard to build technologies where that applies, but it's possible. And I think if we figure that out, where the cheap, the easy, the convenient path is also the path that leads towards greatest freedom and least suffering, then ultimately we'll achieve freedom.
Right? Why did you say that is extremely difficult?
It's easier to build tools that spy on the users, right? Because any information you spy on users helps you to make a better product, right? You know exactly what users want, what they like, what they don't like about the app, for example, or any tool. And that makes it easier to build something. And having a protocol where the least amount of information is shared about the user to the creator of the tool or to the outside world, that's hard. That's really, really difficult. Because privacy is a really multifaceted approach and security as well, right? You need defense in depth where you have multiple layers of defense so that if any one of them gets compromised, you're still secure. Because some layers will always get compromised, either by strong adversaries or just mistakes of the user. And so having technology that is secure on many layers requires a lot of thought and care and work by the people who create the protocols, the tools, the apps, etc.
What would be the best friend of freedom?
The best friend of freedom are the people who build the tools. Because the tools that we use have huge outcomes over our lives. And depending on the principles of the people who build the tools, they imbue those tools with those principles. And if we can solve a problem very early in the production chains, very early in the stack, right, then anyone who comes downstream will benefit from the solutions that we've laid out. So I think the earliest of the production stages for any technology has incredible effect for all the millions of people who rely on derivatives of that technology downstream. And that's, I guess, why I work more and more on deep infrastructure projects, because once we have that infrastructure solved, we can benefit at length for many people underneath it.
It's funny, as a user, I thought you were going to say discipline, but you put kind of all the pressure on the developer.
Yeah, because there's a really great research paper by the Tor researchers in the early 2000s called Anonymity Loves Company, which basically says that if we are a large group of people, we're more secure and we're more private than if we're a smaller group of people, ultimately. And so how do we get a large group of people together? And the answer to that, in part, is convenience. Right? If every user has to make those difficult decisions on how exactly to use the system, then we'll be dispersed because different users will choose different aspects of it and the crowd will get smaller. But if, for example, the protocol engineers very, very early in the supply chain make all of those decisions on behalf of the users, basically, then anyone who uses the protocol downstream doesn't have to make these decisions again. And so I think that with a good architecture, with a good protocol, with good fundamental tools, we can be secure despite not having this discipline of the end user. And the discipline will absolutely help. And it's especially required today because most tools are not built with freedom and sovereignty and privacy in mind as first core principles.
Why is that?
Because it's hard. It really is hard. Like to build technology that is private, secure, censorship resistant is just difficult. Satoshi said it's bloody difficult. You know, for one, it's just difficult mathematics. Like cryptography, especially the advanced one, is not easy to deeply, deeply understand. A lot of the early, and still today, cryptographic protocols, they break, right? Because someone discovers a flaw in the reasoning or in the logic. And that's a big problem, right? Of the concepts being so complex that it's easy to make a mistake that then leads to something not being securely encrypted, right? Or something not being fully authenticated and so on. So just the complexity in the core aspects of the cryptography and other systems, that's a hard one. But then it's also that, again, these layers of defense and defense in depth, where it's not enough to just encrypt your content, for example, right? Because that might still reveal who is talking to whom, the metadata. And the NSA chief says that they kill people based on metadata. They don't need to read the actual message of the content. It's enough for them to find out who's talking to whom, and they'll send the drones in to make a killing strike. And so it requires a real deep consideration of many different aspects. And if any one of them fails, the system fails. You have to be careful with making strong claims about this is secure, this is private, and always put that in relation to the type of adversary. And then it's just to put all of that together to make it work in the first place. And that's already hard. To make it convenient and easy to use, that's also extremely hard. And then to make it the default for every user so that the user doesn't have to think on what to do, but he just does the regular action and it is secure. That makes it even more difficult. So it's really multifaceted about like theoretical cryptography, applied cryptography and the architecture of designs and system. And then the user experience work of how do we make sure that users cannot shoot themselves in the foot. All of that is hard. And all of that together is like exponentially hard.
What have I been doing during this Bitcoin winter? Mostly stacking sats and keeping them safe in my BitBox. I use BitBox because it's fully open source, easy to use, and I can plug it into my phone. If you need a hardware wallet to keep your Bitcoin off exchanges, offline and safe, go to bitbox.swiss/allinbitcoin for 5% off, or use the code allinbitcoin, or check the show notes. Guys, I've got a quick favor to ask. If you are listening right now, take a second and hit subscribe and the bell if you are on YouTube, or follow on your podcast app so you don't miss the episodes and guests that matter to you. If we've ever given you value, this is the moment to give it back. It's free, it takes 2 seconds, and it genuinely helps keep improving every single episode. And to everyone already following, thank you. You are the reason we've been able to raise the bar. Your support, whether it's a donation, a comment, or subscribing, helps these conversations reach further. It also gives us the push to keep going, keep traveling, keep preparing, and keep bringing you in-person conversations like this. Thank you. Join me at BTC Hell 2026, the Nordic Bitcoin Conference in Helsinki this September 25th, 26th. Use code ALLINBITCOIN for 10% off your ticket. See you there. And see you at Bitcoin Plus Gets Paid in Berlin, October 1st to 3rd. Do you think we are now experiencing a moment where this technology is thriving?
Yeah, absolutely. If you think back to the early days of the cypherpunks, like the mid-1990s, right? They had a couple dreams and visions of what we could do in cyberspace and this new realm of mind. They were thinking about, hey, we can have strong encryption. But back then, there was still the difference between strong encryption and weak encryption. Right? Weak encryption with like a short key, something that could be brute forced with a lot of compute power. Right? Nowadays, every encryption is strong. Like cryptographic algorithms are so multifaceted. There are so many different variants of them. They have different performance trade-offs and so on. But they all work and they're incredibly secure. Right? They have these visions of two computers could connect and communicate without learning each other's identity. Now we have Tor, we have Mixnets, we have VPNs. And they were thinking about how we could have censorship-resistant communication that routes around censorship. And now we have the internet, which didn't exist back then, right? Or at least the World Wide Web. And especially now we have mesh networks, numerous of them, transport layer agnostic mesh networks that make sure that your message will reach the receiver regardless of what happens in the middle. And of course, money was a big, big, big dream of the cypherpunks. Like to have money that the government cannot stop, right? Money that cannot be inflated, money that cannot be stolen, money that's anonymous to use, where nobody knows how much money you have. And that we have that now, obviously. We have it with Bitcoin. We can make millions of transactions per second with the right technologies in Bitcoin. That's incredible, right? And we have marketplaces, right? Since, I guess, the Silk Road was one of the prominent ones, but ever since then there are countless more, and now also with Nostr we have resilient, censorship resistant anonymous marketplaces. These are all wet dreams of the cypherpunks. Like they And it took an incredible amount of engineering, of thought, of talent to speak that into existence. The early cypherpunk mailing lists were like, I don't know, 20 people, right? Maybe 5 of them, 10 of them really, really active. It was a very, very, very small group of people. And if we now consider the users of the tools that the cypherpunks created, we're probably at like 6 billion. Everyone uses encryption, right? Like, you cannot use the internet without encryption nowadays. It's the default for every user, right? We have, I don't know how many millions of users of Bitcoin and anonymous marketplaces, etc. Like, it's the extent to which the cypherpunk dream has become a reality is absolutely staggering. And I don't think that even the most ambitious cypherpunks could have like thought of the extent of how fast and how swiftly the technology actually comes around. I mean, sure, many would have liked it to be sooner, but if they would have realistically thought about it, it's a multi-decade project, and we've come very, very, very far. And that's just thanks to the visionaries who you know created the stories that inspired people to build, and then people actually picking up the shovels and doing something with it. It's a lot of work. It's hard work, right? But it's very rewarding work. And we've seen more and more people join that ecosystem and the movement and keep building amazing stuff. And I don't see that trend stopping. I think it's still speeding up. Like, as fast as we've come, as fast as all of this happened, as many people as are involved now, I think in the next 5 years, we'll be making another leap that is equivalent to the things that we did 20 years ago.
What do you think could stop this train?
I think people losing the care. People no longer caring about security, sovereignty, individual freedom. And if that is no longer a priority to people, they will not build and use the tools that ensure it. So apathy, right, a lack of care, that is ultimately what I think brings down civilization. And I hope that we'll build a community and a culture that's strong enough to keep that care, to foster it, and to pass it on to the next generation.
And when it comes to that, what do you see happening in the new generations? Do you see people care more about privacy, self-sovereignty, and freedom? Or people that prefer convenience and they don't mind sharing their lives or their information?
Yeah, I think it kind of went more extreme on both sides. Again, if you compare to 20 years ago, most people didn't think about privacy at all.
Right? Yeah.
But also, most people did not share their entire life with the entire world. Right. And now with social media, it's very common to upload a picture of every food that you've ever eaten, right? And share exactly where you are at any point in time, and who your friends are, etc. So there, over the last 20 years, 10 years especially, there was a lot of oversharing, or like a lot of revealing of information that previous generations would have thought crazy, right? But I think simultaneously, a ever larger group of people have realized that the potential downsides of this and the consequences of this. And
could you name a few?
Well, for one, it makes you very easy to be stolen from. Right? There are countless social media influencers who've had home invasions, kidnapping attacks.
But if you know are an influencer?
Yeah, but even then, right? Like the amount of dragnet surveillance that is out there that catches regular people, right? Who are just everyday people. And then they get targeted for their religious beliefs, right? For example, this is a really big deal, right? Or for their sexual relationships, right? For the question of, are they pregnant or not, right? And then get targeted advertisements for these aspects. Like, these are just aspects of your life that are not the business of other people.
What do they have to fear?
That one day someone will get this information who doesn't have your best interest at heart. Mm-hmm. Right? That is the big threat. Like, and that's hopefully a rare threat, right? That governments and criminals don't really care much about you and come after you. But it's not a given, right? We've seen numerous times where government regimes changed, and all of a sudden the actions from 10 years ago, where things were still normal and permissible, all of a sudden were like really criminal. Like, remember COVID, right? Meeting your friends in the park was all of a sudden a crime, right? And if the police caught you, you would get into serious trouble for sitting on a park bench next to each other, right? Mm-hmm. These are the types of switches that can happen way quicker than we would ever realize, right? Solzhenitsyn has great writings on this, on like how quick and easy it is to slip into this totalitarian regime, right? And you're blessed if it hasn't affected you yet. But there are billions of people alive today that are actively affected by that, where if they say the wrong thing, they go to jail or their children go to jail, right? Or are tortured in some other shape or form. And that's extremely serious. And we're blessed that many people don't have these problems at the moment actively. And you just have to pray that you never will. But some small preparation today will make sure that your prayers are easier, more likely to be answered. If you study history, there are many good reasons to be careful and to not be a fool in the sense of carelessly walking through the world. Right? There are benefits to that as well, right? Of not worrying about all of these things, and most likely they don't affect you. Right? But they do affect billions of people and trillions of people in the history of humankind. Right? So it's not a paranoia that's unfounded. And I really truly hope that you or the listeners will never like have to experience the wrath of the actual tyranny and how bad it can get. But I care about the people who are living under tyranny today. And to be honest, it's much larger than you would think. Like back in the days, you know, slaves still had their own property. Like they still had a lot of food. They still had their own shelter, their own clothes, etc. But like today, we have tax rates that exceed 70%. Right? Like at what point are you a slave, you know, with how much wealth is being stolen from you on a daily basis?
When you say 70%, are you exaggerating?
I'm not exaggerating. I'm probably like, that's a lower estimate. I mean, here in Austria, right, we have 50% income tax, mm-hmm. right? We have 20% value-added tax. Not sure where the value is added, but they steal 20%. So that alone is 70%. Two taxes, right? We have, I don't know, 150% tax on diesel. I don't know how much tax on tobacco and alcohol. Right? There's a lot of tax on food. Right? There's, you know, you need diesel to produce food because you need to fuel the tractor. Mm-hmm. Right? And all of these taxes ultimately get passed down to the consumer. And that's not yet even talking about inflation, which is the most common form of wealth transfer from the people to the government today. And we have inflation rates that are staggering. Like, I don't know, more than half of the money that's in existence was created in the last 5 or 10 years. Right? These are staggering, staggering numbers of direct theft that is happening. And then on top of that, you have to see the unseen, right? The consequences of where would we be today if we wouldn't have stolen so much money from everyone? And where would we be if all the entrepreneurs that create beautiful solutions to really difficult problems were not hindered and tortured in all these different types of aspects? And we would be past immune at this point. And so the seen and the unseen of government intervention is shockingly scary. And that, you know, is something that we have to fix.
Where do you think we would be without this interference of the government?
Yeah, it's almost indescribable. Mm. Like, if you think back, you know, 200 years ago, I don't know, 70-80% of the village had to be farmers just to stay alive. Right? You couldn't do anything else but create food because we were not efficient enough, right? We didn't have the capital, the tools, the strategies, the ideas to produce food for a whole bunch of people. So we all had to do it ourselves. And now that sounds crazy. Like your job didn't exist back then. Like to be a podcaster, you know, that's it's ridiculous, right? That this is actually like a profession, right? We couldn't have afforded these types of luxuries even 100 years ago, right? And look at where we're now, where we have like equipment like this that allows us to reach millions of people all over the world for almost free. Right, so we've come a really, really long way, and I think a large part of that is freedom, right? And having the ability to save and to produce and to build and to trade. And without that, we would still be in the Stone Ages. But if you would think about, okay, what if we would let this actually run and not be in the way of the people who produce? We cannot comprehend. Like, it's just like the peasants on the field 100 years ago could not comprehend, you know, what we're doing now in the house that we're sitting with, the equipment that's all around us, with the cars that drive. Like, this, all of this didn't exist 100 years ago. And so where would we be? I think we would be in, like, staggeringly rich. And I don't mean, like, you know, having a lot of money in the bank account. I mean, we would have so many of our fundamental problems solved. And I don't think that hunger would be a thing anymore. Like, there wouldn't be people starving. I think that most diseases would be healed and cured. I think that, you know, any type of leisure or culture that we would want to see would be created. We would have fantastically beautiful music, art, architecture. All of this would just be staggering, like incomprehensible to what we have today.
Nice to dream. If governments banned privacy tomorrow, what would you do?
Leave all the governments behind.
Okay. How?
By resisting them, right? By saying no, and by taking the consequences that would arrive from that. You cannot give up privacy without giving up your humanity. And privacy is the ability to selectively reveal yourself to the world. It's a choice of what to say to whom and when, ultimately. And if someone doesn't grant you that right, right, that ability, then you're no longer human. Right? If you no longer have the ability to make up your mind and to not share sensitive information with others, that ceases to be human. Like, that is worse than an animal. Right? And I don't want to live in that world. And I would do the best to reject it and to live in a reality that is different. And any security technology, including Bitcoin, including encryption, including privacy, right, relies on the axiom of resistance. Meaning that if someone wants to take it away from you, you have the ability to say no, right, and to simply not do what the attacker wants you to do. And yes, there might be consequences to that, but ultimately, if you do not resist, the technology will not work and will not help you.
What do you hate most about Bitcoin?
Bitcoin is such a ugly system. There, like, in many aspects, like the fact that if you want to get paid and you want to verify that the person actually paid you proper money,
yeah,
the fact that you have to verify every transaction of everyone else,
mm-hmm,
is ludicrous. It's so stupid. Like, it doesn't make sense on so many levels, right? First of all, it doesn't scale. Like, if every 8 billion people would make all of their, I don't know, 50 transactions a day, and I would have to read every single one of them, it's a crazy system. So it would probably break under load if we would actually seriously use Bitcoin, at least the blockchain of it. And then also, it's not private, right? I don't have the choice to not reveal myself to the world in the aspect that I'm making a Bitcoin payment, which coins I'm spending, which addresses I'm paying. And all of this information is required by the protocol to be revealed to everyone, not only to the receiver, but literally to everyone. So Bitcoin doesn't scale because it is not private. And that's a massive, massive, massive problem. Because we need digital sound money that's censorship resistant, inflation proof, all of the beautiful aspects of Bitcoin. But the hacky way that Bitcoin gets us there is ugly. Right? We can do a lot to improve that. Right? The Lightning Network, client-side validation. There's a lot of amazing, amazing technologies that we can use to improve the situation. But the fact that we have to work on it so much kind of sucks.
You mentioned that Bitcoin is not private. And there was this possibility of making it private on the first layer. But as I understand it, then you wouldn't be able to check the cap.
There's a couple technologies here that make you know, a system like Bitcoin more private. The first is to hide the amount of the transactions. So in the current Bitcoin system, every transaction has inputs and outputs. The inputs are the coins that you've received in the past and that you're spending now. And each of them has a value, let's say one Bitcoin, right? And then on the output side are the addresses that you want to pay. And each of these addresses gets an amount of Bitcoin associated, right? Let's say you want to pay 0.7 Bitcoin. Since you put one Bitcoin on the input side and you put 0.7 Bitcoin on the output side, you still have 0.3 left over. And so you put that back into a change output that goes to your own address, right? But now everyone on the entire world knows that you've spent one Bitcoin and created 0.7 and 0.3, right? And that the cool thing is, it's very easy to make sure that you didn't create money out of nothing, right? Because you could have created one Bitcoin on the input side and 10 Bitcoin on the output side. But if you would allow that, very easy inflation, the money would die, right? What we can do instead is use some fancy cryptography, homomorphic encryption, where we can hide the values, the amounts of Bitcoin on the input and output side, and prove in zero knowledge instead that the values of the outputs is smaller than the values of the inputs without having to reveal the actual amounts themselves. Right? Beautiful, beautiful cryptography. The problem is, if we ever have a bug in the system, then people could create one Bitcoin on the input side, 10 Bitcoin on the output side, and the proof might still be valid, you know, that the verifier would think that, okay, no new money was created, but in fact, there was new money created. This did happen in the Zcash blockchain, right? Back in their original Saplings protocol, they had an inflation bug, an undetectable inflation bug, right? And the developers found out about it. And the developers didn't tell anyone. The developers then fixed the protocol in the background and made an upgrade, a fork to the blockchain. And then later, after that fix was deployed, they told everyone that, hey, we had this bug and we couldn't tell you, because if we told you, anyone could have exploited it and cheated the system. But to this day, we don't know if the developers didn't create more money out of thin air. Right? That's the problem with cryptography and the complexity of it. It's bloody difficult, again, to quote Satoshi. Like, there are so many inconvenient or unintuitive ways that it could break. And then if it does, it might be catastrophic. And so Bitcoin uses very little cryptography under the hood, signatures and hashes. Very simple, very well understood. All of this other fancy zero knowledge magic that we can do is an option to use, but it comes with complexity and that comes with risk. And so that's why Bitcoin is still such an interesting thing, because it strikes this very near perfect balance between complexity and security and censorship resistance. And changing it in some ways makes it better on some of these aspects, but drastically worse on others. And that's kind of the risk of changing Bitcoin entirely.
Tell me about the moment your view of the world completely changed.
I remember very well the very first time I read a book by Murray Rothbard. It was called For a New Liberty, a New Libertarian Manifesto. It's a very short pamphlet, only a couple pages long. And it explains you the economics of freedom in an incredibly, incredibly intuitive way. And as I was reading it, I could not stop. I was sitting in my hammock. It was already late at night, and I couldn't stop. And when I finished a book after midnight, I had to read it again. And that was for the first time where someone so clearly, so simply, so intuitively explained with perfect, impeccable reason the purpose of freedom and the consequences of freedom, as well as the consequences of slavery. And the definition of slavery, right? In such an elegant, eloquent, approachable way that it blew me away. Like, before then, I was deep studying economics, and I read so many Keynesian economics books, so much modern monetary theory, you know, public choice theory, all of this nonsense that is convoluted, complex, and the end result is we need the government. Always. That's always the end result of all the mainstream economics of we need the government, otherwise everything goes to shit. And I then later discovered the Austrian school and Ludwig von Mises, Hayek, and so on. And they all really started to open my eyes on, okay, there is a better form of economics out there. But then it was with For a New Liberty that really radicalized me on deeply despising slavery and emphatically and courageously loving freedom. And I don't think I've been the same ever since.
When was that? How old were you?
I was probably around 16. Yeah. No, 15, 16, something like this.
Mises or Hayek, and why?
Mises, absolutely. Mises is one of the most prolific thinkers in human history, for sure, of the 20th century. We owe so much to him. It's incredible. Like his rigorous mind and his care for humanity is second to none. And he lived in a time of tremendous turbulence, where the world was kind of on a balance of where do we go, right? Towards more collectivism, socialism, communism, fascism, and war. And unfortunately, that's the side humanity chose. And he was trying his best to get us to get into the other direction of individualism, sovereignty, freedom, markets. Right? And he got very close, very, very close. But ultimately, he failed, right? In saving humanity. And he was there throughout the First World War, the Second World War, and the nightmares that followed. And he tried his best to tell people about this and to warn them. And his early writings in like the 1920s, even in 1913, are already so perceptive of the danger that is ahead of us and the consequences of those fundamental misunderstandings of reality that economists and social theorists had up to that point and after. He was just such a deep, deep, deep methodological thinker. He was one of the greatest economists to ever live, but even more so, he was one of the greatest philosophers and someone who really thought deeply about thinking itself. Right? He was very particular about methodology. Here in Vienna, there was a fantastic Methodenstreit, they say in German, which is basically a disagreement over method. Right? There was the historian school, who was very prevalent and it later turned into Keynesian economics and so on, that basically had as the method of analyzing economics that we need to look at the history of nations, the history of collectives, and to then see what worked in the history and apply that for our economic reasoning in the future. Fundamentally, deeply, deeply flawed methodology. And he pointed that out. Because, first of all, collectives do not act, right? Collectives are masses of people. And sure, we can see, you know, what they do or we can't even see what they do. We can see what individuals do. And then we can see if the collective, the nation, the society prospers or falls. But what he pointed out is that the actual focal point, the actual unit of analysis is the human individual, right? And that this is where we have to start. We can then later deduce, you know, how societies will fare given different choices of individuals. But we have to start with the individual, and then later comes the collective, the society, the nation. If we start with the nation, we can never come back to the individual, right? Because we cannot take a coarse image and get it to be sharp. And the same disagreement on methodology, by the way, happened here in Vienna for psychology as well. Right? Basically, Jung was on the individualist psychology versus the Zeitgeist and kind of collective psychology of nations. So there were quite similar methodological disagreements in different areas of economic thought happening right here in Vienna, the end of the 1800s. Unfortunately, to many aspects, the collectivists won. And that led to an uncounted amount of suffering. Right? That Mises so precisely predicted in like 1913, before the First World War, before the Second World War, before all of the wars that happened after. Right? He's so clearly articulated that if we continue going down this road, it will lead to an ungodly amount of suffering. And unfortunately, he was correct. But fortunately, he inspired countless other thinkers to build the alternative that we now have with the internet, with Bitcoin, with freedom technologies, that is fundamentally rooted in his understanding of human action.
Who were Mises' influencers? Who was he reading at the time?
He was an incredibly eclectic reader, really like a polymath. He was interested in so many different topics. And he read all sides of the aisle, both sides of the aisle, like even in economics. If you read through the footnotes of his books, he deeply, deeply understood the historicism school, for example. Very, very well read there. But ultimately, the shoulders of the giants that he stood upon were Karl Menger and Eugen von Böhmerwerk. Both of these were living here in Austria as well. Karl Menger had one of the most pivotal insights in economics. He solved one of the root issues that went all the way back to Plato in economic thought. Back then, people were convinced that the value of things is in the things. Right? The chicken is valuable because it can do things. It produces certain aspects like eggs and meat and so on. Right? And that led, for example, the Wealth of Nations.
Adam Smith.
Adam Smith, thank you. So this intrinsic value theory was adopted by Adam Smith later. And that is a fundamental flawed assumption or starting point, which then later led Karl Marx into his horrendous labor theory of value, which then led to communism, socialism, and countless of millions of dead people. And Karl Menger put his finger on something, that value is not in the thing itself. Value is in our hearts and minds. Value is what people do, the perception of people about things. And this, again, deeply individualistic, right? And deeply intrinsic. And subjective, right? So this was the first powerful, powerful insight that started the Austrian school. The Austrian school is called the Austrian school not because of Mises, but because of Menger. Menger lived here in Vienna, and Menger had this pivotal insight to start with, right? Value is subjective, and value is marginal. Two powerful insights, meaning that if you're starving...
But very controversial, I imagine.
They were absolutely controversial back in those days. And there were countless, countless debates and ongoing back and forth, both in person and in writing. And you can read some of those writings. And they're fantastically interesting. Like back then, people really cared about methodology. You rarely have these levels of conversations nowadays. But they did in the coffee houses of Vienna, especially.
If someone wants to start reading Mises, which book would you recommend?
If you would like to start with Mises and you haven't done much study on economics before, I would actually start with Mises' biography. It's not written by Mises. It's written by Jörg Guido Hülsmann in 2007 or even later. And it explains the set and setting in which Mises grew up, both his personal life, but more importantly, the history of economic thought before then. And it introduces a lot of Mises' original thoughts, together with the fascinatingly compelling and exciting narrative of his actual life. So that's probably a good book to start, to understand where he's coming from. If you then want to read his actual books, I mean, the one book that any scholar of economics has to read is Human Action, which is his magnum opus, his grand treatment. Where the name praxeology is literally in the title, right? Praxeology is the logic of human action. And human action is what he identified as the actual starting point, the axiom of economic reasoning, that you have to you know, take upon if you want to study this. His book on socialism is fantastic. This is the book that got everyone mad about him. All the communists were mad. All the fascists were mad. You know, Hitler tried to kill him because of this, in part, because he really pointed out why socialism doesn't work, right? And the calculation problem that ensues, right? That under socialism, the abolition of private property, you cannot trade if you don't own the goods. And if you cannot trade, there are no prices. And if there are no prices, we don't have an objective measurement of the value of things. And if we don't know the value of things, then we cannot allocate the things carefully and properly. And ultimately, that leads to poverty. And again, hundreds of millions of people could have saved if that reasoning would have been understood. I think the book is from the 1920s, right? So that book is fantastic. He has The Theory of Money and Credit from 1912, right? A year before the American Federal Reserve was created. He has completely demolished the reasoning and logic of central banking and the importance of a sound money freely chosen. So these books are his important achievement. Theory and History, another fantastic book on the methodology, on why the historicism school or empiricism is the wrong way of thinking about economic problems and why his praxeology is a proper and useful way.
PBDCs, private bank digital currencies.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on them?
So that's a sharp question that I will need to walk around for a while to really make my point clear. There's money proper. Money proper is a base money. It's a thing in of itself, usually a resource like physical gold. It could be a digital resource like Bitcoin, right? But ultimately, if you hold that good, you don't hold a claim by anyone else. You hold the thing itself. The thing is not dependent on anyone else performing anything. It's not a debt, no obligation. It's the thing itself. And you hold it and it's yours, right? Like physical gold in your hand, like Bitcoin on your own private keys. Then you can hand over your base money to a service provider. Let's call it a money warehouse, right? And the service provider will take the base money into custody and he will protect it for you, right? So you still remain, you still retain the legal title to the base money, but you give up possession over it, right? So why would you do that? Because it's cheaper. It costs money to hold base money and to protect it well. And there are economies of scale, meaning if one company holds the money of hundreds of people, they can buy a bigger safe. They can hire more guys with guns, and they can do so much more efficiently at lower costs per unit of money that they protect. And so that's why money warehouses exist. Now, how does the money warehouse keep track of who owns what in there? And one way of doing this is with a money warehouse receipt, right, or a money substitute. Think of it as a piece of paper on which the service provider writes, whoever has this paper can withdraw 1 ounce of gold, right, or one Bitcoin, right? And now there is an exchange happening where the money warehouse provider takes the physical gold and he gives you this paper slip that says you can redeem the gold at any point in time you want. Right? That money substitute is a claim on base money. Right? It's not the thing itself. Meaning if the money warehouse runs away with all of the money, your paper is worthless, right? Because the money is gone that this paper was supposed to be a claim against. So all of a sudden we've introduced counterparty risk, and counterparty risk comes at a cost. Right? It comes at benefits as well, because I can have, I don't know, 100 kilos of gold on one tiny piece of paper, and I can hide that in my pocket and cross borders without anyone knowing. Hiding 100 kilos of gold is a little bit of a different affair, right? So it's cheaper, more private, easier, and just generally more efficient to use these money substitutes, with the caveat that there's a huge risk that the guy might run away with your actual money, right? Or inflate the supply of these paper receipts, right? Maybe he has 100 kilos of gold in the vault, but he issues 1,000 tokens or paper receipts, right? And all of a sudden we have fractional reserve money warehousing. Big, big, big problem. So what's the equivalent of this analogy in the modern fiat life? Right? The base money of the fiat world is physical notes and coins. Right? These are the paper receipts. They are now no longer a claim on something. They are the thing, right? Which is kind of crazy to think, because whoever produces them can produce them at a tremendously cheap cost. Like, to produce a $100 bill costs, like, I don't know, 7 cents. Right? That difference, by the way, between the cost of producing base money and its face value is seigniorage. That's where the theft is happening in money printing. That's why they stopped printing the 1 cent, right? Or not printing, but like minting it, right? Because it cost them 14 cents to produce 1 cent. That means they make a loss. The government loses money, and the treasury loses money whenever they create a 1 cent. That's why they stopped doing it, because the only reason why they want to print money is to steal from you, right? If it costs them more, they're not stealing anything, so they stop doing it. And instead, they're creating now the what? $1 trillion coin, right? Because there is a lot of money to be made there, because the seigniorage is substantial. But still, any amount of physical currency to be created is expensive and therefore decreases the seigniorage and the theft opportunity of governments. So what they started doing instead was to create a digital form of base money, which is the central bank reserve. Right? The central bank has, for all intents and purposes, an Excel sheet, a database, where it can just click a button and create 1 trillion units, right, of the thing that is the base money. Kind of technically speaking, it's their obligation to print that base money later, like to actually give you physical access to that amount of cash. But nobody actually comes and redeems this, but technically that's their obligation. But it's still treated as base money, right? Meaning if you hold a central bank reserve, you have not a claim against anyone, but the thing itself, and you can trade it as is. The problem is, you and me, we cannot get our hands on a central bank reserve, right? That, for this, you need to be a bank and you need to ask for permission. And they very frequently reject the permission. You know, Custodia, one of the earlier Bitcoin banks, tried to get a central bank account and they got rejected. I think now the Kraken Bitcoin exchange got a central bank account, right? So they lobbied a lot, probably paid a lot of bribes to actually get access to this, but it's difficult, right? And they might reject you. And so this means that all digital fiat money that you hold right now is not money. It's not base money proper. It's a money substitute. Right? And you think it's money, but it's an obligation that the bank has to eventually give you cash. And they very often deny you the right to redeem your money substitute for money proper. You can only get out, what, $1,000 a day out of your ATM? Right. More than that, you have to ask for permission very, very carefully.
And explain why you want it.
And explain why you want it, exactly. And they're very easy to reject you. You're withdrawing from the money warehouse, right? Ridiculous. And of course, they have a fractional reserve of between 0 and 1%. Right? So if you have 100,000 bucks in your bank account, that does not at all mean that there are 100,000 cash bills available in the bank. At most, there is like 1,000. Most likely, it's actually zero. And banks can create money substitutes with nothing in reserve. And that's how the modern banking system works. Highly, highly inflationary. So whenever you go to a bank and you take out a loan, for example, they just create it out of thin air. Literally, with nothing backing it. No hard asset, no money proper. So first, before I get to the private digital bank currencies, the original, much more common phrasing is the central bank digital currency. The central bank digital currency is basically a way for you, the end user, to get a direct access to the Federal Reserve, like money warehouse, so to say, like the base money itself. You can get a digital base money directly issued by the central bank, which means there is no longer a claim behind it. Right? It is the money itself. There is no middleman, no entity that could go bankrupt. The good itself is in your digital hands, so to say. So a private digital currency is basically just a bank account. Right? It is equivalent to what we have right now with banks. The bank has some reserves, allegedly, hopefully, in the central bank assets, right? Balance sheet. And they will give you a token. Most bank accounts are accounts, right? So you have one ledger and there's incoming and there's outgoing. And that's how every banking system works at the moment, right? But you could have a bearer asset private digital currency, which is a token, you know, on some ledger, be it a blockchain or an eCash system or just an Excel sheet, right? Where the token can be passed around, and either you have the token or you've given it to someone else. It's a little bit like the difference between Ethereum's account system and Bitcoin's UTXO system. So a private digital currency token would be like a UTXO-based, token-based system such as Bitcoin, versus the bank account being an account-based ledger similar to Ethereum's system. But ultimately, both are claims against a bank to eventually give you access to the base money, be it in physical form, cash, or potentially digital form, which would be the central bank digital currency.
When I think of private bank digital currencies, I think of stable coins, Tether, Circle.
Exactly.
Okay.
So a stable coin is basically that other aspect, right? The Bitcoin-like bearer asset that is a claim on base money of the fiat currency, right? You can go to Tether and you can deposit, you know, $100,000 in cash or in a bank transfer, right? And give them the base money or a fiat claim on the base money. And they will then create a token on a blockchain. Could be Bitcoin, Ethereum, Tron, whatever the fancy is at the moment. Could be their own internal ledger, right? But they will give you a token, not an account, but a token that you can then send to others. So this is an innovation on fiat banking. It's functionally equivalent to the money warehouse of fiat banks at the moment, just that it runs on modern rails. Where legacy banks use the SWIFT network or the SEPA network to move those tokens around, Tether, the Tether bank, the Tether money warehouse, uses blockchains and digital modern technology with stronger cryptography and so on. But yeah, fundamentally the same.
So what would be the main difference between private bank digital currencies and central bank digital currencies?
The issuer of the token, the person who signs the paper receipt in the earlier analogy, right? With a central bank, the central bank signs it themselves, right? And that means that it's base money in the proper sense. The central bank is not saying, I will give you anything if you give me this paper back. The central bank says, here is the paper. It's the thing that you can trade with. I will not take it back.
By decree.
Yes.
Yes.
They've created it out of nothing, right? So the benefit of a central bank digital currency is that there is no middleman.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You're working directly with the government or the treasury. There is no company in between you and the base money.
Okay. Right?
You hold the base money. It's quite common that banks close your account, right? That the banks take away your money, right? That they ask for extra information. And so there's a middleman in between you and the government, ultimately. Which has benefits, right? One less company that's involved, one less company that could steal from you. It also means you're working directly with the government.
Yes,
which is also a downside. Yeah. Especially because the government now has direct access to your spending history. Right? If you have a regular bank account, the government doesn't directly know how much money you have, where you're sending your transactions to. The government will have to ask the bank for this information. Most banks, probably all banks, will give that information freely and have automated processes. And maybe even the bank initiates and just sends every transaction that it does to the government, right? But ultimately, in theory at least, you could have a bank that does not collaborate with the government, or at least puts costs on the government in order to get that information. You know, it needs to have a subpoena, court order, judges, etc. I guess Tether to some extent is doing that, right? Like, at least initially, they didn't work with the government. now they're at the scale that they very much have to, and they do. But you could have a smaller private digital currency issuer who does not collaborate with the government. There's also decentralized versions of this, right? The decentralized stable coins, basically, that don't collaborate with the government. And in this case, it would be more difficult for the government to seize the money and to spy on you and to put on controls, right? Because it has to convince the bank, the money warehouse, to do a certain thing. And if it cannot achieve that, for whatever reason, because it's in a different jurisdiction, because it's a decentralized operation, then you would have benefits. With a direct central bank digital currency, a direct government tokens, there is no one who could protect you from the government. Right? And so the government can easily surveil you. They see every transaction you've ever made. They can easily impose programmable limits, like you can only spend this money in this area, right? And you cannot leave your 15-minute city with the tokens. That is something that is actively being discussed with central bank digital currencies. Right? Again, banks could implement the same thing, but there's at least some competition among banks that makes it less likely that they are abusive to their users or customers, because the customers would leave. With a central bank digital currency, you can't leave unless you refuse the government entirely, right? So less competition for government services in general, which always leads to a worse service.
What's praxeology and why do you care about it?
Praxeology is the logic of human action. That's what it literally means. I think it comes from the Greek. Ludwig von Mises popularized the term. Right? He didn't invent it, but Mises really brought it to the forefront and built an entire science around it. So you can think about it as, what are the consequences of human action? Right? Where psychology is more like, what are the reasons for human actions? Right? Why do we do the things that we do? I don't know, I was traumatized as a child, or, you know, that would be a psychological question. The praxeological or economical question is, what are the consequences of that action? So a proper praxeological sentence would be, minimum wage leads to unemployment. Right? The consequence of enforcing a minimum wage, of forbidding people to trade a good below a certain market price, means that people do not trade that would have traded. So it means people will not have the goods that they would like, because they cannot afford the higher price that is mandated. Right? So minimum wage leads to unemployment. And then praxeology has a couple different subsections. It's about economics, which is basically the science of resource allocation, very roughly speaking. Right? And then it also is about catalactics, which is specifically the study of trade. Why do humans trade? And what are the consequences of their trades? Under which conditions does trade flourish, etc.? There's monetary theory, right? So what is the money? What makes a high quality money? There are questions of interest rate, right? And credit systems, etc. But then there's also ethics, right? What ought humans to do? What is a good action and what is a bad action? Hans Hermann Hoppe revolutionized praxeologic science by introducing ethics into the same realm of methodology. Fantastic work. So why is praxeology so important? Because it is what I found the only and most concrete way of having useful explanations of human relations. And it very clearly tells you the consequences of theft are bad. It's bad for everyone, including the thief. The thief suffers when he steals, because he does not gain the opportunity cost of having wealthy members of society, right? That would build things and solve the problems that he himself has, right? So thieves fundamentally misunderstand economics, because if they would, they wouldn't steal, because we all suffer from theft. And it does give you the rationale of why freedom is beneficial, because we all get filthy rich. Right? Not in a monetary sense, but we will solve all of our problems if we're left to our own devices, and if we encourage and incentivize the solving of problems rather than put hurdles in between.
Tell us about the praxeology of privacy.
Yeah, so this is the book I've been writing, it kind of feels like the last 20 years.
Okay.
I really started putting it to paper about 5 years ago, but I've been really deep in the study of economics for about 20 years, and I've learned a lot, and I come to understand things like, you know, slavery is really bad. Then for the last 10 years or so, I've went really deep down the cypherpunk rabbit hole and explored what privacy actually is, why it is so interesting, why it is so important, and especially then what are the technologies that we can use to express privacy and protect it. And what I found is that most economists, including the Austrian economists, don't understand the cypherpunks. Right? They don't understand their mindset. They don't understand their technologies, and they don't understand their strategies. And that means that most Austrian economists totally slept on Bitcoin. For the first, I don't know, 5+ years of Bitcoin's existence, almost every Austrian economist was unanimously saying that Bitcoin is a bad idea. Right? It's not a proper money. And that's fundamentally flawed, right? And simultaneously, all the cypherpunks who've built these amazing technologies, amazing cryptographic systems that can liberate humans to an unheard of extent, they don't understand praxeology and economics deeply, right? They make mistakes. They build systems that utilize the beautiful cryptography, etc., but that have fundamentally flawed assumptions. And if the tools that you build are not in accordance with the laws of nature, then they will fail almost inevitably. Right? And I think both of these traditions are incredibly valuable to humanity. A proper understanding of resource allocation, etc., is essential for us to solve any problem. A proper understanding of the cryptographic technologies and the implementation strategies on how to deploy them to billions of people is what will get us out of slavery. And both of these traditions kind of misunderstand each other. And I've had the privilege of being at the forefront of both of these for now quite some time. And I just would love that my friends understand each other better, you know? And so this book is there to bridge these two traditions, right? To teach the economists about how their reasoning applies to the modern world. Like, you know, famously, Murray Rothbard, one of the greatest economic thinkers ever, on par to Mises, maybe greater, he only used a typewriter, right? He died in like 1995, I think, right? So computers were around. He never used them. Mises, who I think died in the 60s or 70s, also, of course, never used any computers and so on. And then on the other hand, there are countless cases of beautiful cypherpunk tech that failed because of a deep lack of understanding of the economics. And now there is a small overlap of cypherpunks who know Austrian economics and Austrian economists who really appreciate and value the cypherpunks and practice those strategies. But this book is hopefully the one-stop shop that I can give to both sides of like, you're both correct and the other guys are correct too, and you should really talk. and that will be the practical, actionable way of how we can lift humanity out of slavery in the 21st century and fix all the dreadful mistakes of the last century. It's now in its third edition. And it, just a couple days ago, I received the first copies. You can get it on Amazon, the physical copy. It will be available for Bitcoin, the physical copy, soon, hopefully this weekend. And also the digital copy is available. You can get it on towardsliberty.com/pop, praxeology of privacy. And it's free. The digital copy is for free. And it's published in the public domain. If you want to print it, if you want to sell it, please do it. Like, I don't claim ownership over these ideas. I think you cannot own ideas. I think that's a very stupid idea. Big part of the book, by the way, that ownership is rooted in scarcity. And we need ownership to allocate scarce resources. But the beauty of ideas is that they are free, that they are not scarce, that they are not rivalrousness, right? That we can share ideas without having to give them up, without having to sacrifice them. That's, again, one of the things where the cypherpunks were early. Like, Cypherpunk, since forever, we're working on free open source software, where the code was published for anyone to use, to modify, to sell, to do whatever you want. Because it is, first of all, the strategy that's rooted in reality, and also the strategy that will give us the most amount of freedom in the shortest amount of time. And it took until Stefan Kinsella in 2013, I believe, to publish the book Against Intellectual Property, which is the praxeological take on the information space. Right? So again, here, this is one of the things that for decades, the Austrians deeply misunderstood the power of free software and free ideas, where the cypherpunks got it way earlier. And there are still huge disagreements in the Austrian circles of whether ideas ought to be ownable or not. And I'm very much with Kinsella on that point, on that view. Copyright, patent are deeply, deeply evil. Not only do they steal from people, but they hold back humanity to a massive extent. So this book isn't mine. Like, yes, I put it together, but none of these ideas belong to me. And if you want to share them, if you want to reprint them, if you want to sell the physical books, it's your paper, you printed it, right? Go ahead, do with it as you please. Don't have to pay me. I'm not doing this for the money. I'm doing this for the freedom. And any additional copy that we can print and get into the hands of people will hopefully make a small difference. And that's all that I care about.
You call yourself a cypherpunk.
Yeah.
Why?
Because the cypherpunks have come up with the strategy of freeing humanity, and they've effectively deployed it over the last 20 years at a ever increasing pace and an ever increasing scope. Like, we not only have strong encryption to protect your private conversations, we now have anonymous communications to talk to people without revealing your location, etc. We have anonymous sound and digital money like Bitcoin. And all of these are technologies that the cypherpunks have built. And I play my small, tiny part in bringing these technologies a step further. There's also the saying of cypherpunks write code. And the interesting thing is that I've never really written code. I'm not a developer. I don't create the software programs themselves. But I love to work with the people who do. And one of the realizations I had early is that we need much more than just writing the code. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that has to be done as well. Like sitting right here and spreading the good word about the cypherpunks and why they matter so incredibly much. And my role is everything but code. All the other stuff that needs to be done to make the cypherpunk vision a reality. And that's what I've been focusing on for the last 10 years. So I've built the tools without necessarily having to write the code.
What do I have to do to become one?
Build tools. I think that's ultimately what the cypherpunk dream is actually about, of proliferate the technologies to extend freedom, sovereignty, privacy into the digital realm. And to create a society of peace that is much more widespread and prevalent than it ever could have been in the physical reality. I think we have a tremendous opportunity with cyberspace of creating a realm that the governments do not own, a realm that they cannot control, a realm where free and sovereign people will choose to peacefully live among each other instead of stealing all the time.
Can I become a cypherpunk with a podcast, having conversations about privacy with you?
Yeah. Cypherpunks not only have to build those tools, but use them, right? And, you know, my journey into the cypherpunk rabbit hole started with videos and podcasts as well. Right? Originally, my first content was all about economics, because that's what I understood back then, what I've really studied deeply. But then it was with discovering Bitcoin that I realized the power of the technologies.
I followed you for a while, as you know. You've been working with Wasabi, right?
Yeah.
I remember following a tutorial with you, doing step by step what you told me to do in order to open a BISC account.
Nice.
You did plenty of great tutorials, by the way. Thank you for that. What you were doing, is that cypherpunk?
I think so, yeah.
What I was doing, is that cypherpunk?
Yeah, I think so too.
As a user?
Yeah.
Okay.
And what you're doing now, right, to do the marketing, so to say, of those technologies, is a fundamentally important part of delivering the tools, right? Because we have amazing technologies that nobody knows about, right? Let alone knows how to use them, right? So I think your role right now is mainly to raise awareness, right? It might not yet be to do the technical deep dives on how to use them, right? And then there is also the thing of helping the developers to build it. Like, one of the early things I did was just to find bugs. Like, I was using software and it didn't work, right? And instead of, like, complaining and throwing the software away, I told the developers about it. I was like, hey, I wanted to do this. It didn't work. Here's the error message that I got. Here's how I think it should work. Right? This is incredibly, incredibly valuable feedback to any builder of technologies. And then another aspect is that in development, there is this concept of a rubber duck, right? So, and you and me were perfect rubber ducks. So what a rubber duck basically is that a developer has a really difficult problem to solve, you know, and he's thinking about the code and he can't really figure it out. And he's sitting in front of his computer and like hacking and it just doesn't work, right? The solution is take a bath, right? Chill for a bit. And then you have this rubber duck in your bath, in the bathtub, right?
Okay.
And then you just talk to the rubber duck. And you're like, hey, look, rubber duck, this is what I'm trying to do. And like, it's not working for these and these reasons. And these are the errors. Oh, wait a sec. I think I got it. That's the type of conversation that I have all the time. I just am on a call with developers and they complain to me. And I'm almost like their psychiatrist of listening, saying, mm-hmm, yeah, exactly. And maybe once in a while, like, have you considered that? And that's extremely helpful for the developers to have just someone there to talk to and to maybe ask some questions at the right time. And that is integral of solving the problems. So I was part of so many conversations that ended up inventing something beautiful. And I didn't invent it. But I was just there nodding along, you know, with a smile and occasionally throwing in one of my own thoughts on how I'm thinking that this might work. And not only is this super helpful to the developer, it's incredibly helpful to you. Like, again, I had zero technical understanding 10 years ago, right? And I
That's
just...
That's so not true, but go on.
No. It really, really is true.
I remember years and years ago, you wanted to buy this computer. And you were accepting Bitcoin donations. How to do some coding? How long ago was that?
Well, that was 8 years ago.
Yeah,
probably.
I remember.
Well,
that.
That's two less than 10, right?
Yeah, so like, it's true.
No, but really, like, I think in 2016 I made the switch from Windows to Linux because a friend told me about Linux for the first time, right? And that's kind of that kicked off my journey into the cypherpunks. And later I discovered Bitcoin, right? So literally 10 years ago, I was a complete technical normie, really. Like, I mean, okay, I did put together a computer, you know, a gaming computer. Like, that was probably the pinnacle of my understanding of computer science, was how to plug in, you know, the cables and the graphic cards, etc. And really everything else that came from there was just listening to videos and podcasts, and then especially to join the developer calls. Like, I was there in the developer calls for BISC, BTC Pay, Wasabi especially, right? And just listening to the developers talk about this stuff. And slowly I've assimilated all of this knowledge and gotten much more technical, but really it's not been that long. And you absolutely have it in you to do similar, right? Now, you might not want to go into that detail. You can focus on other areas, obviously, and that would be valuable as well. But it's not rocket science, really.
I think you may have a tutorial on Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, I remember this was such a traumatic experience of trying to install Bitcoin on a Raspberry Pi in, like, I don't know, 2017 or something. And like, in hindsight, what I was trying to do was impossible. Like, I was trying to compile the source code on a Raspberry Pi, and I don't think that's even possible. So, like, oh, of course, I didn't know. And I was just following an old guide on how to do it on a regular laptop, and I thought a regular laptop and a Raspberry Pi is the same. They're not, right? It was weeks of agony and suffering. And that's why I was such a big fan of the Raspberry Blitz. And Noddle, I think Noddle was the first box
powerful books.
No, no. And Casa?
Yeah, Casa No Two.
Yeah. Yeah. But then you are buying it from someone, from a third party. It's not like doing it yourself from scratch, like the cypherpunk way of doing it. But
yeah. But, you know, that's where kind of my economic understanding comes in of nobody knows how to produce such a simple thing as a pencil, right? Let alone how to build a computer, right? Humans are screwed if we're alone. We can do nothing alone. Like, the amount of things that we could produce alone is negligible. And we would probably die before we produce anything substantial, right? The famous iPencil essay by Leonard Reed, right?
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. Or like there was this YouTube video of a guy who wanted to produce a sandwich fully all by himself. It took him a year, right? Like it's okay to work with others. Like we're social creatures. We like to be with others. We like to solve problems with others and for others. And we need others to solve our problems, right? And only if we leverage others can we produce anything substantial, right? Like all of the podcast right now, right? I mean, it's just a conversation, but in order to produce this, we need millions of people, right? To produce the microphone, to produce the cameras, the lights, the computers, the internet infrastructure, like the applications so people can watch it or listen to it. It's impossible to produce anything substantial without the help of uncountable people, not just today, but decades ago. That built all of these ideas, that then built the machines, that built the machines, that built the machines, that then built the tools that we need to use in order to build the thing that we will want to give to someone else, right? So collaboration is beautiful. And like that cypherpunk ideal of, you know, don't trust and verify and do everything by yourself. It's a cool meme, but it's far, far, far from reality. Like even the cypherpunks implicitly trust an enormous amount of the technological stack. Like, it's called signature verification, but there's still an uncountable amount of assumptions in simple thing as a signature verification, right? So here again is where the economics and the cypherpunks, I think, should meet in the middle.
Okay.
And like value the collaboration and the trust that we have to put in others to make sure that we're building something beautiful and impactful.
When did you first come across Austrian economics and what's your relationship with it?
I'm very, very thankful for my mother to put me into child labor early on.
Child labor. Okay.
She is.
You're going to have to explain that one.
Yes. She strongly encouraged me to get a job.
Uh-huh.
She basically said that. At age 9.
Hmm.
So she was always, you know, providing me with the basics. Like I was never lacking food, shelter, clothing. A very, very good, pleasant childhood, amazing. But she encouraged me to, if I want to have, you know, something extra, some luxuries, you know, a new toy,
mm-hmm.
you know, ice cream, etc., that I have to work for it. It doesn't come out of nothing. You have to first work and solve problems and save, and then you've earned the privilege of enjoying some luxuries. Right? That basically encouraged me to start working, right? My first job was picking up newsletters or newspapers, right, and distributing them. And I very, very quickly realized that work can suck. if it rains and it's cold and it's dark and you still have to go out and walk for miles to hand out the newspaper, you know, the question of why do we work kept coming up. Like, why do I have to do this? This is ridiculous. Why don't we just chill? You know?
Yeah. Do I want a toy?
Yeah, that's the other thing, right? As soon as I actually then earned the money, I was like, I worked so much on this. I'm not going to spend it on like some ice cream that's gone in a minute. Like this toy, I'm going to forget about it in a couple days or weeks. So no, I'm not going to spend my money on this. So very soon she taught me just by practice, by participatory knowledge, the ethics of working hard and then of saving and not spending your money frivolously. So I'm eternally grateful for her with that.
What does she do for a living? How did she come up with this?
So she was a full-time mother for the longest time. And that's another amazing thing. Like if people have the chance to be full-time parents, that's amazing. And so she did a fantastic job with raising us. So I ultimately wanted to answer the question of why do we have to work? And I wasn't quite satisfied with her answer. Like, she didn't have a good, like, economic understanding or reasoning. It wasn't really her interest. So I kept asking why? And she was a bit overwhelmed. So she just took me to the library and was like, well, pick up some books. And I started picking up economics books, like textbooks. And these...
8, 9.
Yeah, 9 or 10, something like this, shortly after starting to work.
What's the sort of book you go for at that age?
The mainstream textbooks, right? The things that they were teaching later at high school or universities, and mainstream economics, Keynesian modern monetary theory.
What was your first book on economics?
Oh, honestly, I don't remember that. You know, I kept reading these books, and I realized that, first of all, I don't understand what they're saying, right? And they're not even talking about the questions that I have. Like, none of them were talking about why do we work, right? And like, how to improve our work, etc. It was all about aggregates and like GDP and, you know, interests and credit and stuff like this. And I was like, this is not what I'm looking for ultimately. So I kept looking, right? And then eventually found Milton Friedman from the Chicago School.
At the library?
Yeah. He was referenced in one of those books. And I was like, okay, I'll check out that. And that started to make more sense. And then from there on, I think next was Mises. I think he mentioned Mises. It might have been Hayek. And then when I read Mises for the first time, I was like, oh, wow. Like, I understand why we work. We have to solve problems, right? Humans have problems. We have to allocate our means, our resources, to alleviate those problems and to remove uncertainty from our lives. And that was like such an obvious answer, but it made sense, right? And so I kept reading and then later discovered Rothbard specifically, like For a New Liberty, where that really came to the full conclusion of anything that hinders us from solving our problems is just bad. And we shouldn't adore it at the very least or worship it. And we should abolish it rather, right? So that then turned me into a proper anarchist, right? Of anything that hinders human growth and flourishing is bad, really, really, really bad on many, many different levels. And Rothbard really then gave me that value of ethics and knowing right from wrong. Right? And then later Hans Hermann Hoppe really like solidified that with his axiom of argumentation. Like, argumentation ethics is a logical proof on theft is bad. And it's performative contradiction if you try to refute that. And so anyone with, you know, a decent mind and the willingness to accept truth, I think has to agree with that ultimately, right? So it really led me to then also go deep onto the monetary theory. Like, I was a gold bug and a fiat money hater long before I discovered Bitcoin. Because I understood the massive amount of suffering and resource and misallocation and boom and bust cycles that money printing creates, right? And the fundamental inequality of making so many people poor just that a few people can get rich. And that just never stood right to me. And the sad part of that part of my life was just a basically massive depression. Of understanding the evil parts of theft, and especially the monetary theft, and then realizing that gold isn't good enough. Like, gold failed, and trying to using it again now in the modern world where so much is digital will not work, right? And or has very little chances of working. And so that was a tough time of like knowing the evil and not having a solution to it. And I think that's why I was then so eager when finally I found the cypherpunks, because they've provided solutions, right? They were quite accurate in their description of the problem as well, not as accurate or nuanced or in-depth as the Austrians. But for any like serious question of, okay, so what do we do about it? Every Austrian economist was just, well, the market will solve it. I was like, but we are the market. Like, how do we actually solve it? You know? And then the cypherpunks figured it out. And that's why I went you know, heads deep into the rabbit hole for finding the actionable solutions that we can actually use today and the things that are still missing that need to be built.
All this information you found and these discoveries, who did you share them with?
You know, mainly with my family, especially my mother, mm-hmm. who was not as radical as me. So that was a lot of tough dinner conversations. You know, that's whenever someone discovers something new and gets really enthusiastic about it. I think we all know it regarding to Bitcoin, right? You can't shut up about it.
Yeah.
Even though people would love that you shut up about it. And I was definitely one of these really annoying teenagers who thought that he knows everything and everyone else is stupid and just kept hammering down. So I love her for sticking with me through that time.
How many economic schools are there? And can you briefly explain their main ideas?
Yeah, there are quite many. So we've already briefly touched upon historicism, which tries to look at a past history to then deduce future outcomes. We briefly touched on Keynesian economics, which is basically an analysis of government actions and advancing global economic or global societal benefits, more or less. It's talking a lot about aggregates and so on. We have microeconomics, which is kind of Keynesian theory applied to individual businesses. This is a lot about bookkeeping and so on. And macroeconomics is more the term for kind of the general societal economic reasoning. We have public choice theory, which is how can we structure government action so that it leads to a better outcome? There's the Chicago School. Conclusions of the Chicago School are basically that a sound money is useful, right? That governments ought not to increase the money supply at length, right? But still that there are some what they would call market failures where supply and demand don't meet at a perfect point. And there are some discrepancies that the market cannot solve and where the government has to step in, right? Like, for example, providing courts and so on. Yeah.
And you don't have that with Austrian economists.
Some Austrian economists are minarchists, and so they do prefer government to take over some actions. Again, it's quite common courts because it is an easy shortcut to have an ultimate decision-making power to allocate right or wrong legal theory, right? I personally think we can do much better on a free market with competition and without monopolies. So, yeah.
Thank you for your time and this generous conversation, Max. I've learned so much. Where can people find you and your work?
Yeah, I've withdrawn from all of the social media centralized platforms that, mm-hmm. again, steal from you in roundabout ways. And I'm only on Nostr nowadays. So if you want to find me, all my videos, all my articles, my book is all available for free on Nostr. So go to towardsliberty.com. It's my personal website where you see all of the content and ideas that I've created and disseminated, let's say. Check out White Noise. That's the current main project that I'm working on. Check out all the other freedom tech tools that are so very, very valuable. And read Rothbard, like read Ludwig von Mises, read the giants of the Austrian school. They have taught me so much and given me so much positivity and conviction while simultaneously shining a light on all the darkness that is happening. And I think with shining the light on the darkness is how we have a chance of removing it.
That's a great tip. It's been a pleasure having you on. I can't wait to have you back. Until then, stay sovereign.
Thank you very much, CK. This was a lovely conversation. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for the prep. Thanks for inviting me here. Looking forward to the next one.